Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Later this hour, we'll take a trip back to a classic interview with Jane Goodall, and we'll put some cicadas on your menu. But first, you've heard the expression, as numerous as the stars in the sky or the grains of sand on the seashore. But sand isn't actually in unlimited supply across the globe, and our demand for it keeps growing, for everything from the sidewalks under your feet to the glass screen on your phone. There's no danger of planet Earth running out of sand, of course, but the economics and the ecological impacts of the sand industry are shifting. Joining me now to talk about the ecology of sand is Dr. Aurora Torres. She's a postdoc in the Center for Systems Integration and Sustainability at Michigan State University and at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get a definition first. What do we mean when we say sand? What is it?
It's simply a matter of size. Sand is defined by a specific grain size. So from 16 to 1 to 2 millimeters is just very fine grains that define what sand is. But actually, the composition or the shape can differ. And it can be made from natural materials, from fragments of rocks and minerals, but it can be also made by pressing plastics or recycled concrete and mortar.
Not all sand is the same, and I think that we all have this experience. If we walk on a beach on the Mediterranean or we walk on the beach in the Northeast, the sand under our feet is a little different. Is there good and bad sand for different types of uses?
Yeah, so it depends on what is the final use of sand. For many different types of applications, we don't have to be very strict about the quality of the sand. But for certain things like producing glass or for the microprocessors that power our cell phones, then we need a very high quality of sand that is quartz sand, almost basically 100% of quartz.
If we're going to make sidewalks or we're going to make a building out of concrete, what type of sand do you want? Where do you want that sand to come from?
It can be from a multitude of places. Many people think that the ideal type of sand comes from river, but actually we can make crust rock that can be of similar or even higher quality than the sand that we find in the river because we have better control over the sizes of the grains, the distribution of the grains in the sample, the shape. We can make angular sand or more round sand, depending on the use. So mainly speaking, that type of sand that we use for concrete is coming from rivers, floodplains, glacial deposits, and crust rock.
Let's say you take sand from the Sahara Desert. Is that something that you can build a building out of?
It's not the ideal type, and it will require a lot of processing to be able to use desert sand. Many teams are looking for opportunities to do that possible for the places that are next to the deserts, of course. But in principle, it's difficult because the grains of sand have been eroded by the action of the wind, and they are very round. And also, if you look through the microscope, it's like all the grains of sand look the same. While ideally what we will expect to find for a good mix of sand to make concrete is a diversity of grain sizes with different shapes and slightly different sizes. And we don't find that in desert sand. So that's why this is not an ideal type of source.
So you're saying that sand that's uniform in size and shape doesn't make good construction materials, but sand that's diverse in its size and its different qualities, that makes better construction material. Why is that?
If the grains are very round, then the mix is not strong enough and the concrete kind of collapses. So for the mix to stay together, you need these angular grains of sand. But it also gets complicated because if it's too angular, then it might not be that good. So it has to be within a certain range.
Do we know how much sand is on the planet?
No, we don't know. That's still a question that is yet to be answered. There is no geological assessment of deposits and their uncertainty that has been conducted. So we don't know. We think it's very abundant. If in general, geologically speaking, it's widely distributed on land, on freshwater system, in coastal areas. but we don't know how much sand there is and how much sand of different qualities is on the planet.
So when we say that there's a sand crisis, I mean, there's no real chance of running out because we do have a lot of sand. So what are we talking about around a crisis of sand?
So it's mainly our relationship with sand, what is changing. Sand is a material that has been used for construction for very long time. The Egyptians started to make a type of concrete, the Romans perfected the technique, but it has been since the 50s, 70 years ago, that with population growth, urban development and infrastructure development, the extraction of sand and gravel has accelerated to the point that these are now the most extracted materials in the world beyond fossil fuels and biomass. We extract 50 billion tons of sand and gravel every year. And then this is bringing environmental and socioeconomic implications. So that's why we talk about a global sand crisis.
Demand for oil may be slowing down because we're finding other ways to power ourselves. Are there alternatives to sand that people are looking at in order to stop this looming crisis?
Yeah, that's very interesting because making this comparison, as we are transitioning now from gas and fuels to renewable energies, not because we completely run out of these materials, but because of the environmental implications, we are trying to find secondary resources that can replace sand and gravel found in river systems that are highly vulnerable. And the main substitute to sand and gravel is crass rock. And this is already the main source of aggregates in places like the United States or in Europe. And we are seeing an increasing adoption of this type of production that is basically come from blasting and crushing rocks of different types, granite, sandstone, basalt. A wide diversity of rocks can be used for that purpose. And we also see a widening range of secondary resources that can be used to satisfy the demand for aggregates. The main one is recycled construction and demolition waste. But in the future, there will be probably increased adoption of recycled plastic, byproducts of steel production, byproduct of other mining industries. So there is potential for reducing the demand for primary materials.
You mentioned that sand is so in demand around the globe and it's so heavily extracted. We made the comparison to the oil industry. Are we seeing wars over sand the same way that we have seen wars over oil?
Well, it has certainly become an issue that has created geopolitical conflicts. One of the clearest ones is in Singapore that has been growing by 23% in the last decades because of massive land reclamation projects for urban development. And this has created conflicts with the countries in Southeast Asia nearby Singapore, because Singapore just doesn't have enough materials for all this construction that is going on. So it has to rely to a certain percentage on importing these materials from neighbor countries, from Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia. Singapore was accused of stealing sand from islands in Indonesia, and a total of 23 islands disappeared in a very short period of time. And after that, Indonesia accused Singapore of this illegal extraction. And there has been a succession of exporting bans to Singapore because of accusations of environmental impacts associated with this extraction. And also within countries, we have seen that as sand mining has become increasingly profitable, and when there is not a strong governance in place, many illicit supply networks have emerged. And one of the best examples is in India, where there are multiple operating Indian sand mafias taking control of these resources and threatening local communities and also being blamed of murdering hundreds of people in the last years in sand wars.
That's extraordinary. Sand mafias.
Mm-hmm. It's really surprising. And it's not only in India that happens, but also in China, in Kenya. In Baja California, there are problems also of illegal mining. So it's quite an extended problem when there is weak governance and a very high demand.
What do you think we can do to make sand more sustainable?
I think we need a more careful monitoring and planning of the resources that we have. We need a better understanding of the physical system. So to put it in simple terms, to know what the geological resources are and to understand the extraction flows and how they accumulate on urban areas, because in the future, they might be secondary resources. And in this physical system, we should also get an understanding of the secondary resources that are available in a given place that we might be able to access in order to promote a transition towards a more circular economy that increases the efficiency in the use of the materials and reduce the reliance on the primary materials. But there is also a bit of an uncomfortable truth that was highlighted by a report of the International Resource Panel last year. In this report, they concluded that material efficiency strategies in the construction sector can achieve big gains in terms of reducing climate change emissions. But the ones that are going to be really more influential are the ones that require a societal transformation. So moving into more lifestyles that require less material. And interestingly, that goes against the tide of ongoing urban sprawl and increasing floor area per capita that is expected to double in the next year. So unless we couple efforts in technical measures with social measures, we might be eating up what we gain by increasing material efficiency. So yeah, that's something we need to find out how to make that societal transition towards decreasing the material demand per capita.
Dr. Aurora Torres is a postdoc in the Center for Systems Integration and Sustainability at Michigan State University and at the Catholic University of Louvain. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, it's time for a Sci-Fry Rewind. We'll dip into the archives and revisit the life and work of Jane Goodall with Dr. Goodall herself. Stay with us.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. More than 60 years ago, a young scientist named Jane Goodall first set foot in what is now the Gombe Stream National Park in Tanzania. She'd go on to make groundbreaking observations of chimpanzee behavior, including tool use, personality traits, and even their darker, more aggressive side. Since then, she's gone on to advocate for environmental conservation and for a view of nature that places us within the animal kingdom. Late last week, it was announced that she was this year's winner of the prestigious Templeton Prize for her work changing our view on animal and human society. So we thought it was a good time for a Sci-Fry Rewind. Ira interviewed Dr. Goodall for the first time in September of 2002. They talked about her first entry into the world of chimps, her many discoveries, and her hopes for a better future. It was, I must say, a lovely interview. Take a listen.
Thank you very much for coming in to join us today, Dr. Goodall.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. Gilbert Grosvenor, chairman of the National Geographic Society, once wrote about you in one of your books. She was hardly the image one would project to become an old African hand. Her bush experiences were honed in the genteel English countryside.
Well, it wasn't exactly genteel. I wouldn't have described it like that. But, you know, animals were my passion from even before I could speak, apparently. So I was watching earthworms in my bed when I was 1.5. And I hid for 5 hours in a hen house when we had the opportunity to go into the country because we lived in the town. Because I was collecting the eggs. And, you know, there was the egg. Where was the hole big enough for the egg to come out? Nobody told me, so I hid.
you wanted to watch it.
And I watched it. And it was my first, you know, wonderful experiment. And then when I was about 10, 11, I found the books about Tarzan of the Apes. Fell in love with Tarzan. He's got that wife, Jane, you know, so I was terribly jealous of her. And that was when my dream started. When I grew up, I would go to Africa, live with animals, and write books about them. That's how it all began.
And how did you fulfill that dream?
Well, I got the opportunity when a school friend invited me to go and stay on their farm in Kenya. And I was working at the time with Documentary Film Studio in London, which is a great job, didn't pay very much. So I quit that, went home, and worked as a waitress and served people there breakfast, lunch, tea, and dinner until I'd saved up enough money to buy my return fare by boat because it was cheapest in those days. So, you know, I was 23 and I sort of said bye-bye to family, friends and country and off I went. But we had arranged a job for me in Nairobi, a boring job, a secretarial job, but at least I would be independent. And that was when I heard about the late Louis Leakey. And somebody said, Jane, if you're interested in animals, you must meet Louis. So I picked up the telephone, cheeky me, and made an appointment to go and see Louis Leakey. He was then curator of the Natural History Museum in Nairobi.
And were you around then when we made that famous discovery?
No, I was the year before.
Just the year before. Oh, just missed
Which was so lucky.
It was
because,
lucky.
Yes, because it was absolutely unknown. We just spent all day chipping away in the rock. And then Gillian and I were allowed out on the plains. And all the animals were there, the antelopes, the zebra, the giraffes. And then one evening there was a rhino, which was a little bit scary. And one evening, a young male lion, 2 years old, totally curious, never seen anything like me and Gillian before. And he followed us for at least, well, a couple of football pitches. It was like being at home.
And so then how did you find your way toward working with the chimps?
Well, it was during that Olduvai time that Louis realized that I was the sort of person he said he'd been looking for about 10 years. So he made this suggestion to me. It took him a year to get the money. I mean, who was going to give money to a young girl, a female, who didn't have a degree of any sort, straight out from England? I mean, what a ridiculous idea. So I was in England waiting, learning what I could about chimpanzees while he searched for money and eventually found a wealthy American businessman. And said, okay, Louis, here you are. Here's enough money for 6 months. We'll see how she does.
And you did pretty well.
Well, it was a very, very worrying time because I got to Gombe. Again, I felt I was at home. But the chimpanzees ran away as soon as they saw me. You know, they're very conservative. They'd not seen a white ape before. And I knew if that 6 months' money ran out before I'd seen something really exciting, you know, I would have let Louis down. Well, we told you so. This is ridiculous. But fortunately, just before that time came, I saw the first observations of using and making tools. And that was the saving observation, the breakthrough. Of course, at that time, you know, we were defined as man the toolmaker. That right. was supposed to differentiate us more than anything else from the rest of the animal kingdom. David Greybeard, bless his heart, I saw him crouched over a termite mound. Couldn't really see properly. They were still not very relaxed in my presence. I was hiding, but I knew he was using a piece of grass. And a few days later, he and one of the other chimps, I could see them much better. The whole thing, putting in the grass, picking the termites off, picking a leafy twig and stripping off the leaves, which is the beginning of tool making. So that was it.
Exciting.
It was, I couldn't actually believe it. I had to see it about 4 times before I let Louis Leakey know. And then I sent a telegram and he sent back his famous comment, ha-ha, now we must redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans.
Well, now, I know you do wonderful chimp calls. I'm going to try to get my engineer ready for this because Jane tells me it's pretty loud. So tell us what call you're going to be giving.
Well, I'm going to do the greeting, and it's the kind of sound you'd hear if you went to Gombe and you climbed up onto the ridge in the morning and you listened. And if you're lucky, you hear the chimpanzee who's calling out saying, here I am, it's a wonderful day, where are you? And
wow.
Each one has his or her own individual voice, so you know exactly who's calling.
So like we can tell on the phone who the chimp is, you can also tell.
Yes, correct.
You were, I want to pick up on the you having to get a PhD. You went back, and they were just aghast at you.
Yeah, they were.
Whippersnapper, upstart.
Yeah, it was even accused of teaching the chimps how to fish for termites, which, I mean, that would have been such a brilliant coup.
Besides your initial discovery, what has been most surprising to you?
The most surprising and shocking, really, was when in 1970, that's after 10 years of research, we realized that chimpanzees have a dark side, just like we. I thought they were so like us, but rather nicer. And then to find that they're capable of brutality, that they may even have a series of events not unlike primitive warfare, that they can attack members of another social group so severely that those individuals die as a result of their wounds, and that infants can be killed. And that was very, very shocking.
Mm-hmm. And why it took 10 years, about 10 years to discover that?
Well, because the boundary patrols are right out at the far end of their range. And I suppose we just weren't following them far enough. But also the warlike, you know, we called it the four-year war, that was a rather specific circumstance. And it was when our main study community divided, and when those two groups had sort of completely separated, then the males of the larger group began to systematically annihilate the split-off individuals. So it was almost like a civil war. And it was very, very shocking.
Let's go to Sharif in Philadelphia. Hi.
How are you doing? I wanted to know if you believe there are any undiscovered large ape species, and if you believe that the bonobo chimpanzee is a subspecies of the chimp or a separate species.
Okay, well, I'll do the second one first because that's easy. It's definitely another species. I mean, it's known, it's described as another species. It's a bonobo, not a pygmy chimpanzee. Different in many, many ways.
What a wild species that is. I mean, just incredible.
Yeah. Right?
Rich species. Things that they do that we never thought.
That's right.
The chimps do.
Yes. Chimpanzees, bonobos, and humans genetically are equidistant. As for the other, you're talking about Yeti or Bigfoot or Sasquatch.
Is that what he's talking about?
Yes, he is.
is that the message I'm missing here?
I think that's the message you're missing.
Is that right, Sharif?
Pretty much.
Well, now you'll be amazed when I tell you that I'm sure that they exist.
You are?
Yeah. I've talked to so many Native Americans who've all described the same sounds, two who've seen them. I've probably got about 30 books that have come from different parts of the world, from all over the place. And there was a little tiny snippet in the newspaper just last week, which says that British scientists have found what they believe to be a Yeti hare, and that the scientists in the Natural History Museum in London couldn't identify it as any known animal.
Wow.
Now, that was just a wee bit in the newspaper, and obviously we have to hear a little bit more about
that.
Well,
this age of DNA, if you find a hare, there might be some cells on it.
Right. Well, there will be, and I'm sure that's what they've examined. My little tiny snippet said that don't match up with DNA cells from known animals, so apes.
Did you always have this belief that they existed?
Well, I'm a romantic, so I always wanted them to exist.
All right, Sharif.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. How do you go looking for them? I mean, people have been looking, or has this just been, since we don't really believe they could exist, we really haven't really made a serious
search? Well, there are people looking. There's very ardent groups in Russia, and they have published a whole lot of stuff about what they've seen. Of course, the big criticism of all this is, where is the body? You know, why isn't there a body? And I can't answer that. And maybe they don't exist. But I want them to, and so I...
What needs to be researched out there? I mean, what is missing from the picture?
Well, one of the most fascinating areas for research is cultural differences between different populations across Africa, or even different neighboring communities. And of course, it's still controversial as to whether chimpanzees can have culture, but I define it very simply as behavior that's passed from one generation to the next through observation, imitation, and practice. And tool-using behaviors differ quite markedly across the species range in Africa. Now, we've just begun to skim the surface of these differences. But even as you and I are speaking, chimpanzees, along with their cultures, are being wiped out right across Africa. So from about 2 million 100 years ago to the very maximum 200,000 today, and that's more likely to be 150,000, mostly in tiny, isolated fragments where there's no possibility for long-term survival because the gene pools aren't big enough.
And they're dying. Why?
They're dying because of habitat destruction as human populations grow. They're caught in wire snares set for other animals, but they catch the chimps and gorillas for that matter. And they either die of gangrene or lose a hand or foot and can't compete very well reproductively. But the worst threat for chimps today is the commercial bushmeat trade, and that is the hunting of animals for sale in the big towns, not subsistence hunting, which has gone on for hundreds and hundreds of years. But this has happened because the logging companies have made roads into the heart of the last great forests of the Congo Basin. Hunters go along the trail. They now have transport. They shoot everything. They load it on the truck. They take it to the towns, where the elite will pay more for it than chicken or goat.
No kidding.
That's Ira Flatow in conversation with conservationist Jane Goodall. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. In case you're just joining us, we're listening to a 2002 interview with Ira Flatow and conservationist Jane Goodall in recognition of her recently winning the prestigious Templeton Prize.
Do you see yourself as an effective spokesperson for the environment now? There are so few people.
One of the remarks that's so often said to me after a lecture, people come up and they say, "You have re-inspired me to do my bit. You have made me feel that my own life is more worthwhile."
But do you think that people who might be tougher to reach with that message might be more inclined to invite a Jane Goodall to speak or listen to you as someone who was a quote-unquote a political environmentalist?
Well, I do know that when talking to people who perhaps think very differently, the only chance you have of getting them to think in a different way is to touch the heart. And if you're strident, if you start accusing people, if you point fingers, then you immediately see the eyes glaze over and you know that you're not getting across. And, you know, I have to go around and think that so much of what goes on that, in my view anyway, is a mistake, is due not to any kind of criminal intent, but simply because people honestly haven't understood. So I feel that that's my job. My job is to help people understand and to think about the future. I mean, if just imagine what this world would be like if we went back to the old tradition of the Native Americans who said every major decision has to be made with the question, how will this affect our people 7 generations on? Hmm. Even if we could just say 2 generations on, even 1 generation on, it would be helpful.
Yeah. Do you miss, though, the forest?
I try and keep the forest in me. That's what I have to do to remain sane. But when I do go back to Gombe, you know, it's to be out in the forest, even without a chimpanzee, to be in that timeless world where it's soft and where life is entwined and you actually see the pattern of nature. And I always feel this great spiritual power, which I believe is around.
It must rejuvenate you.
It does, absolutely.
What do you want to be remembered for?
I think I'd like to be remembered as someone who really helped people to have a little humility and realize that we are part of the animal kingdom, not separated from it. The various results from chimpanzee research has done a lot to soften scientific attitude. And then about my work for the environment, let's wait till I'm dead and see what sort of impact I've had, then I can tell you.
And so you're going to continue to travel?
I have to, well, as long as I can.
Because?
Because it's making a difference. Because I can see the result of a visit like to mainland China. The Minister of the Environment said, "Dr. Goodall, I would like your programs in our schools." And it's changing the attitude of children to animals.
So in your quiet way, I mean, you're sort of in the background until an IMAX movie or something comes out, but you're still working very hard.
I'm working harder now than I ever worked. This is much harder work than crawling through the forest after the chimps. That was just bliss, exhausting physically, bliss. This is, you know, every day, and you take it, you live it. day by day. That's the only way to get through it.
Mm. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
That was Ira Flatow interviewing chimp conservationist Jane Goodall back in 2002. Dr. Goodall is this year's winner of the Templeton Prize, which was announced late last week. If you want to spend more time with Jane Goodall, you can dip into our new archive series, Science Friday Rewind, brought to you by digital producer Lauren Young. You can see photos of Dr. Goodall in the 1960s observing chimps in the field. You can listen to more highlights of past interviews, including my talk with her just at the start of the pandemic last year. And you can sign up for more archival stories at sciencefriday.com/chimps. After the break, can we take the ideas from the flat-packed furniture at IKEA to your pasta pot? Yeah, we'll noodle over that, coming up after this. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. When I walk down the pasta aisle at the grocery store, I am amazed by all the different shapes and sizes. There are those big shells, the twisty rotini, the tubes of ziti, the farfalle butterflies, or maybe they're bow ties. And of course, the flat linguine noodles. Each one for a different recipe, or maybe a different sauce pairing. But what if your pasta could change shape? Here's SciFry's Charles Berquist. Hi, Charles.
Hey, John.
So I love big noodles, the ones that are kind of shaped like calamari rings. But what's this about them changing shape?
Well, researchers are investigating how to get a flat sheet of pasta to fold itself up into tiny boxes or rose flower shapes or spirals when you cook it.
Oh, that sounds cool. So more than just going from dried pasta to an al dente noodle.
Yeah, this is pasta that folds itself up like origami. And I asked Dr. Lining Yao of Carnegie Mellon's Morphing Matter Lab about just why they were working on this problem.
So we were very inspired by the idea of flat pack from the furniture industry. And we read news articles about how furniture is saving millions, if not billions of dollars every year globally by just flat pack. But also that's just good for the environment. When we can't cut consumptions, at least we can cut a lot of shipping space and the packaging cost and space. Similarly, we also learned food packaging is one of the big waste sources. And we thought, hey, why don't we borrow this flat pack idea and combine that with the morphing technique we've been developing and try to think about morphing food. Then if you talk about food, pasta is one of the, you know, the big players because it's a commodity type of food. And we are also interested in starting with pasta because there are very rich shapes in pasta. Macaroni, for example, they pair with different sauce with different surface textures and flavor than spaghetti. But macaroni, comparing to spaghetti, has more than 60% of the packaging space that is used for packing air. And we thought it would be great if we pack, all the pasta flat to save more than half of the packaging space indeed. But then you can still get to eat in the shape you want. It's also just kind of magical. Magic empowered by science. That's the part as researchers we love to enable.
Can you make any shape you want, or are there shapes that are just out of the realm of your capabilities?
So with the grooving mechanism, you can make quite a lot of different shapes. So in the paper we showed, you can make, for example, a quite sophisticated rose flowers. We made shapes like a box, and the common helix, macaroni pasta shape like a cylinder. We also showed, I believe, some saddle shape, a little bit like potato chips. And geometrically, we will define most of the pasta shape as a developable geometry. So as the next step, we are very interested in understanding how to engineer non-developable geometry. Put it into simple words, non-developable shapes are shapes like a dome or like a cone. So if you want to make a seamless bowl or a dome, that's actually quite of a challenge.
So it might be hard to make the all-important little tiny dinosaur-shaped pasta or little spaceships or something like that.
Spaceship, it depends. So another way to understand what we can do right now is if you can imagine the shape being possible with origami, with a piece of paper, you can likely do it.
Okay, so I need to be able to take a flat thing and somehow segment it just with corners and ridges, but I can't pull it. Can I twist it?
You can introduce hinges or folding hinges at locations you want, and then they pretty much self-morph like how origami will fold. But in our case, they do it by themselves, like autonomous folding. And you can do twist, indeed. We actually showed in like a potato chips, if you think about it, it's a saddle shape that is a one twist, but we can also do helical structures.
Is it hard to work out the arrangement of grooves and ridges that you would need to build a specific shape? Or is it just as simple as, I want it to fold this way, I put a groove here, and it does it?
One major intellectual contribution we introduced in the paper is the design guidelines that tell people the rational design behind the shapes we showed. We introduced basically two primitives, if you will. One is parallel grooves. Basically, if you introduce parallel grooves, you basically can introduce a curve, a folded hinge. And another primitive is radial symmetrical grooves. And those will form cone. And then if you combine multiple cones together in different region, in different orientation, you can suddenly make shapes like the rose flower we showed. And this is only step one. Again, it's still more of a geometrical primitive way of thinking about things. Right now, our lab is developing a machine learning powered design tool. And we wanted the tool useful for people who are not interested in understanding DP geometry principles, like maybe a chef. They can basically input or call out the shape they want. So for example, oh, I want a rose flower. And we will be able to convert the 3D shape they want into a flat sheet and also with suggested groove patterns. And in those cases, you just basically need to make a stamp and then directly, introduce grooves on your pasta.
So you're doing origami with the pasta noodles, but walk me through what's actually happening on a physical level. What's causing the pasta to fold?
In the case of pasta, we're actually looking into differential swelling behavior. Basically, the region that is exposed to water will swell more. Where for the places that are covered by, like a groove wall, let's say, the water has to take time to penetrate into the center part of the pasta sheet. So the slight different timing in terms of the water reaching the same horizontal line of the pasta sheet really caused the transformation.
Does it fold towards the groove, away from the groove? How should I be thinking about this?
So when you think about pasta, the pasta will basically fold towards the grooved side. So the convex region is really blocking the water from penetrating. So that basically caused the side with the groove averagely will swell more slowly than the side that does not have groove. So, the side swell more slowly will end up smaller surface area. And then if you look at the system as a complete structure, it will suddenly become a bilayer and bend towards the side with the groove.
So do these rules apply to any material, or is there something special about the flour and the pasta that makes this possible?
The beauty of this phenomenon is this is a universal morphing mechanism. It will work for most of, if not all, material that can readily swell in water or in a solvent. So in the case of edible material, we tried different kinds of flours, but you can also imagine food gels, for example, gelatin, agar, seaweed gels, all these gels can possibly morph in a very similar way. And beyond food, we also showed in our paper, you can make, for example, silicone rubber fold and unfold in a very similar way. But in that case, you will have to use the organic solvent instead of water because the silicone rubber will swell more readily in organic solvent than in pure water.
Are there things out in nature that are doing this already that we haven't noticed?
Scientists definitely noticed, and there are very interesting phenomena in nature in terms of morphing triggered by diffusion. So for example, pine cones, nature made them to be responsive to the moisture level in the environment. And we are very inspired by this similar kind of a nature by layers. But in their case, you know, the swelling is due to the microscopic structures at the cell level and the arrangements of the cell and fiber contents is less about surface groove per se. Swelling mechanism is very similar, but the structure design is slightly different in our case.
Did your lab have a lot of pasta parties while you were working on this research?
We had a few. Once we actually went on a hiking trip, we made a bunch of pasta flat packed in little paper box. And I also had once a pasta party at my home. We actually ended up cooking 3 or 4 different kinds of morphing pasta. I invited my researchers in the lab to try it out. You know, they were chatting, but also giving us some feedback.
And it tastes like regular pasta. Can I tell if I'm eating it that, oh, this is weird origami pasta?
For most of the feedback we got, they didn't really felt this is very different. But like I said, the original recipe is really just made of the same semolina flour and water. They are just different in shapes. Of course, you will have different texture, feeling. That's the purpose of why we want to make different shapes. But yeah, in terms of, we're very proud. The reason we were looking into like a groove and surface texture based morphing mechanism is that we do not want to modify the conventional pasta recipe because food is such an industry that's tied to culture, tradition, right? We want as much as possible kind of preserve the raw material recipe, which is honestly one of the biggest challenges because as a material engineer, we do morphing matter. There are some common techniques, usually by tuning the composition and the chemical structures. But for food, we are kind of constrained in that sense.
Dr. Lining Yao is director of the Morphing Matter Lab in Carnegie Mellon's School of Computer Science in Pittsburgh. Thank you so much for taking time to talk about this with me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And you can see some videos of this magic morphing pasta on our website at sciencefriday.com/pasta. For Science Friday, I'm Charles Berquist.
Hear that? That's the sound of Brood 10. After 17 years underground, billions, maybe even trillions, of cicadas are emerging in one big group, only to mate, die, and to leave behind billions of tiny exoskeletons over the course of about 6 weeks. To some, this might sound like a blockbuster horror movie or a story from the Bible, but for others, like my next guest, it's a chance for a sustainable snack. Bun Lai is the chef at Mia Sushi in Connecticut, and he's here to fill us in on how to hunt and prepare a cicada and how they fit in as a sustainable food source. Bun Lai, welcome to Science Friday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
So you had to travel from Connecticut to Washington, D.C. to be able to get some of these cicadas. Tell us a little bit more about that.
I wouldn't have to travel here if Brood X still came up in Connecticut like they used to. So cicadas are, like many animals, threatened by the destruction of habitat. It just so happens that this time there's just so many coming out that it really makes sense to put it on our menus now.
I mentioned that you go hunting for cicadas, but I mean, is it really hunting for cicadas? Is it hard to find them?
I like to think of myself as a hunter. But it's really a romantic vision of myself. The reality is that it's more like you're plucking cherries off of trees.
If you're searching for cicadas to eat, are you looking for something different? I mean, are there tastier looking cicadas than others?
Actually, the younger cicadas are the tastiest because the exoskeletons haven't formed yet. So they're the most succulent and you don't have that hard shell to get stuck in your teeth.
Yeah. So talk about preparing cicadas. You've caught a bunch of them now, and you have to put together a dinner for people. What do you do with them?
So in the Congo, many insects are, for example, like locusts, which is an agrarian pest that we should be eating, is prepared by boiling them in salt water, then sauteing them in oil or lard. I think the easiest way and the tastiest way of preparing cicadas is to do the same, which is to boil them in salt water like you would lobster, and then sauteing them in some sort of fat, I would say like a really tasty olive oil, and then just sprinkling a little salt on there.
If you want people to actually eat these things, you need to, I don't know, make them feel like this is something that they'd want to crunch down on. So explain a little bit about the taste of a cicada.
eating a cicada is like eating a tiny little soft-shell crab. Very, very interesting, as in there's all sorts of different layers of flavor. I always taste a little bit of popcorn. There's that chewiness of popcorn. I taste all sorts of different types of nuts and even beans, reminiscent of flavors that we're already very used to and familiar with. And I think that also has to do with the fact that cicadas have been coming up out of the ground for millions of generations. It's something that we've been eating for a long, long time. We just don't remember it in our conscious mind.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. I'm glad you mentioned lobsters, because you've talked about this before. Americans are just used to eating these big spiny creatures that come from the sea, but we find a cicada potentially repulsive. What do you think the disconnect is there for American eaters?
Our food preferences are a social construct. So it wasn't too long ago when people in the United States didn't eat lobster. And it wasn't this gourmet expensive food. I also think my mom was telling me how it wasn't long ago when a lot of people didn't like to eat sushi or didn't even know much about eating sushi and thought it was kind of gross too, to eat raw fish. And now it's mainstream. So I think when it comes down to eating cicadas, it's really not that much of a leap. Their preparation is very much the same. And they taste very similar as crustaceans too.
At your restaurant, for years and years, you've been doing this, not just with cicadas, but with other bugs. To talk a little bit more about just the idea of sustainably eating insects in a way that the American diet hasn't necessarily always, I don't know, attached itself to.
Our food system is very, very destructive of the environment. A fifth of the greenhouse gases that happen today come from our food system, primarily from the production of red meat. Cicadas are a gateway to the idea of eating insects, and eating insects is really the opposite of eating beef and its impact, because you barely need to use any water, barely creates any sort of greenhouse gases, barely need any land at all too. So it's the way we've always been eating, but it's also the future of food.
From before, I was asking you about how you harvest these cicadas, how you find them. You're not digging around in the ground for them, are you?
Yeah, so you don't want to dig into the ground. That's what I was going to do when I first came. And then I realized, wait a second, that's a really great way of just destroying habitat. So you wait for them, wait for nature to have them come back out of the ground again. And then you just pick them off the trees and wherever else you find them. It's really, really important for us to go and harvest cicadas from where the soil is clean. So you can't go where there are neighborhoods where there are old houses, because all the ground is going to be leaded. You really need to go into old parks in the woods where humans haven't been.
We've run out of time. I'd like to thank my guest. Bun Lai is the chef at Mia Sushi in New Haven and Woodbridge, Connecticut. If you'd like to see photos of these cicadas and how Bun prepped them, you can visit our website at sciencefriday.com/cicadas. Bun, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Sean.
If you missed any part of this program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts, or you can ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Every day is now Science Friday. Say hi to us on social media too, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or you can email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.